refractor. Pickering himself gauged Eros's magnitude visually by comparing its varying brightness to the stars along its path. Pickering's bid on behalf of Mrs. Fleming failed to win her the 1900 Bruce Medal from the Astronomical Society of the Pacific. In January 1901, however, he learned that he himself was to receive a medal, his second gold medal from the Royal Astronomical Society. The first one, in 1886, had recognized his exhaustive work on the Harvard photometry, or the comparative luster of the stars, as his English admirers described it. The 1901 medal extolled his studies of variable stars and also his advances in astronomical photography. The U.S. ambassador to the United Kingdom, Joseph Hodges Choate, agreed to accept the medal for Pickering at the February 8th ceremony in London. "I do not know when I have heard so much approval expressed about the award of a medal," Mrs. Draper chortled. "Everyone I meet who understands the subject at all is delighted at the compliment paid to you. And what amuses me very much, I am brought in for a share in the congratulations which I do not merit. But I shine a little from reflected glory." In fact, the RAS president, Edward B. Noble, cited Mrs. Draper by name in his prize presentation address. He saw her as the prime enabler of Pickering's award-winning research and commended her beautiful idea to hallow her husband's memory by embracing, enlarging, and enriching the science in which Dr. Draper had labored. President Noble also took the opportunity to praise Mrs. Fleming, that most careful observer among Pickering's lady assistants, distinguished for her many discoveries regarding variable stars and stars with peculiar spectra. He mentioned her name not once, but three times in the same speech. Mrs. Draper happened to be visiting London when Miss Cannon's classification came off the press in late March 1901. Pickering immediately shipped a copy to her, along with a typewritten note expressing his satisfaction with it. Miss Cannon's classification not only unified the earlier work of Mrs. Fleming and Miss Morey, but also clarified the interrelationships among the several stellar categories. The whole population of stars now seemed to be distributed along a continuum according to their spectra. While many stars belonged unmistakably to one class or another, there were just as many that blurred the boundaries by sharing some characteristics of two neighboring types. Miss Cannon represented these overlaps with new numerical subdivisions. For example, she introduced the designation B2A for spectra displaying B-type strong Orion lines, as well as a few of the pronounced hydrogen lines typical of the A-class. Stars labeled B3A tended a little more markedly that way, B5A still more so, and B8A much more. Her system allowed for as many as 10 steps between letters. Miss Cannon thought her arrangement of the classification categories represented the stages of stellar development. Any given star would evolve from type O to type M in the course of its lifetime. Or perhaps progress moved the other way, from M to O. It was difficult to say. Miss Morey's appreciation of the widths and borders of individual Fraunhofer lines had led her to institute subdivisions, which she labeled A, B, C, and AC, which cut across her 22 categories. Miss Cannon missed none of these distinctions, but relegated her descriptions of the waviness or haziness of particular spectral lines to her remarks. The publication of Miss Cannon's lengthy treatise gave Mrs. Fleming no reprieve from the tedious supervision of manuscripts. The backlog of the observatory's unpublished material, according to the director's estimate, would likely fill 28 volumes of annals. He charged Mrs. Fleming to focus her attention on that wealth of data and put it in shape for publication, or at least in such a form that its final publication would not be a matter of great difficulty. In consequence, the tally of her discoveries plummeted Pickering commented on the fact in his annual report for 1901. The number of objects with peculiar spectra found by Mrs. Fleming from an examination of the photographs is unusually small this year, as a large part of her time has been devoted to the preparation of the annals. In October, Pickering repeated his endorsement of Mrs. Fleming for the Bruce Medal. But once again, his entreaty failed to gain her that accolade. A particularly virulent form of grip felled Mrs. Fleming in November, forcing her to miss several weeks of work. Other staff members were similarly stricken that winter season, including Pickering in December. "As you see," the director wrote to Mrs. Draper on January 10, 1902, "I have at last got possession of my typewriter, so that I am now in communication with the world this morning for the first time. I am gaining strength every day, so that, except for observing, I can now do a great portion of my daily work. I have still, however, a great respect for those persons who can climb stairs without difficulty." After wheezing his way up the steps to his office on the second floor of the brick building, Pickering could send photographic plates or messages down again via the dumbwaiter near his desk. Everything in the office stood near some part of the great round revolving desk that all but filled the room. It had been custom built, 8 feet in diameter, to provide as much surface area as a table 25 feet long and 2 feet wide. From his seat at the desk's perimeter, Pickering could easily reach the 12-section rotatable bookcase at its center, or open any of the 12 drawers evenly spaced along the outer rim. Pickering's paperwork, laid out around the desktop in piles, orbited the bookcase. With a spin, he could bring the draft of a journal article to hand, or the sheaf of letters for his signature, or the latest reports from Arequipa. On the morning of February 1, 1902, Pickering arrived to find a present from Mrs. Draper awaiting him. It was a novelty clock for his office wall, along with a note congratulating him on his 25th anniversary as director of the observatory. A fete soon followed, organized by Mrs. Fleming. Toward 11 a.m., she and Mrs. Pickering summoned the director to the photographic library, where all the assistants gathered to offer their good wishes and gifts. The staff of the Henry Draper Memorial had chipped in on a comfortable desk chair. The other assistants gave him a silver loving cup a foot high. Pickering made a short speech, and then everyone shared a celebratory luncheon. "I enjoyed it very greatly," he wrote later that day to Mrs. Draper. "Much to my surprise, for you know I do not like occasions. No one could help enjoying the kind feelings they all expressed, not the least acceptable being those in your letter. Altogether, it seemed to me to be a great success, and I shall always carry with me most delightful memories of it. I want to make my 50th anniversary 25 years hence a more formal affair. Will you help us receive our guests then? Please do not say that you have a previous engagement." In March, when Pickering found the quarterly expenses for the Henry Draper Memorial exceeding Mrs. Draper's allowance, he informed her that he would balance the books by drawing on contingency funds. But Mrs. Draper refused his offer. Her proprietary feelings for the project prevented her from allowing any monies other than her own to support it. "I have quite a sentiment about paying for it myself," she told him on March 30, 1902. "But I do not feel that at present I can increase the amount I have set aside for the work." She would rather see some part of the effort curtailed than relinquish her financial control. Pickering hastened to reassure her, both by letter and in person, that he wanted to manage the memorial exactly as she wished. Meanwhile, the aging, decaying wood of the overcrowded original structures clashed with the observatory's earned stature as one of the largest and most productive institutions of its kind. Pickering compared the mismatch to that of a man with plenty of food who is dying of thirst or who has no shelter in winter. With a $20,000 gift earmarked by an anonymous donor for physical plant improvements, Pickering added a plain brick wing to the brick building, 30 feet square and 3 stories high, big enough to hold another 10 or 15 years' accumulation of glass photographic plates. He also installed a hydrant on the observatory grounds to augment the fire protection provided by chemical extinguishers and electric alarms. Still justifiably fearful of fire, Pickering mandated an observatory-wide fire drill every 2 months, in which all assistants and officers participated. Toward the end of September 1902, when another quarterly accounting revealed the ongoing discrepancy between Mrs. Draper's payments of $10,000 per year and the cost of conducting the project at Harvard, she reiterated her concerns. "You will doubtless think it absurd that I should have any objection to being assisted from the funds of the observatory, but I must confess to having a very strong feeling in regard to paying for this work myself. I hope, therefore, you will excuse my referring to the subject again and not feel annoyed at my doing so." After all, the endeavor constituted her own loving monument to Henry. Although she had long before conceded the impossibility of carrying out his mission by herself, she remained resolute in her determination to fund it with her inheritance. She wished her current circumstances allowed her more leeway, but one of her nephews was selling his interest in the Palmer family estate, and she felt duty-bound to purchase it from him rather than allow outsiders to buy in. Mrs. Draper knew she had every right to insist that the Draper Memorial budget be managed as she dictated, and yet, at the same time, she did not wish to appear unreasonable. On reconsideration, she agreed to let Pickering rely on supplementary support for the time being. "Whatever the indebtedness may amount to, I can return later," she promised, as much to reassure herself as to inform him of her plans. She would need to sail very close to the wind, she said, through the coming winter. But as soon as she settled the family business predicament, she expected to feel quite easy again. Chapter 7. Pickering's Harem. Demand for computer positions at the Harvard Observatory ran so high that some young ladies with college degrees offered to work there for free, for a time at least, until they could prove themselves worthy of hiring. Mrs. Fleming usually deflected these over-eager applicants, even if tempted to avail herself of short-term volunteer assistance. She did not consider it good policy to place the observatory under obligation to anyone for services rendered gratis. Bona fide new job opportunities seldom opened, given the observatory's tight economy and the loyal longevity of its employees. Anna Winlock, for one, had been at her post even longer than the director, and by 1902, her younger sister, Louisa, was nearing 2 decades in the computing room. No one had left to get married since Nettie Farrar's departure at the start of the Draper Project. As Mrs. Fleming could attest, the women now on staff were wedded to their work. No newcomers need apply. Then, all at once, at the start of 1903, the director instructed her to hire 10 new computers. Funding for the sudden expansion came from a $2,500 grant awarded by the new Carnegie Institution of Washington. Pickering had applied for the support through proper channels, but he conveyed his thanks directly to Andrew Carnegie. Aware of the millionaire's commitment to building public libraries, Pickering described the plate collection in bookish terms. "We have this great library of glass photographs," he wrote on February 3, 1903. "Each unique, easily destroyed, and containing a vast number of facts relating to the entire sky, for some portions of which there have hitherto been no readers. This grant furnishes readers who will extract from this storehouse of the history of worlds facts heretofore unknown, and which, except for this collection, could never have been learned, since it contains the only record of them upon the earth." Mr. Carnegie asks me to say that he is rejoicing at the receipt of your note, the steel industrialist's private secretary replied. And he hopes the Carnegie Institution is to aid 100 such things, and is to find, now and then, at long intervals, a man such as yourself to cooperate with. The new readers at Harvard perused the chart plates, also called patrol plates, profiling each section of the sky. They traced the history of known objects and also of new objects as soon as any were discovered. They skimmed the nebulous regions for faint lights previously overlooked. They pored through star fields to recover lost asteroids that had gone missing for years. In March, Pickering wrote again to his new patron with two pieces of news. A few days ago, the Potsdam Observatory announced a new variable star, having the shortest period known. They had observed it carefully during the last 9 months. Our plates extend the work back to 1887. Last night, notice came from the Moscow Observatory of another interesting variable. They have 13 photographs of it. We have more than 200, which without your grant we could not examine. Our library, like the Sibylline books, is the only storehouse of these facts open to human knowledge. You have given us the key by which new facts regarding unknown worlds are daily revealed to us. The Sibylline books contained the collected rhymed wisdom of an ancient Greek oracle, transmitted to the Roman king Tarquinius Superbus by a prophetess. 4 months passed before a personal reply arrived from Skibo Castle, the Carnegie's summer residence in Scotland. My dear professor, go ahead, you are on the right lines. I hope to see you upon my return. I thought probably that I beat the record by selling 3 pounds of steel for 2 cents, but the whole constellation of Orion for a cent knocks me out. Take the cake. Come and see us when you are abroad. Mrs. Draper's financial situation did not improve from 1902 to 1903. In fact, it worsened. For nearly 20 years, she had been channeling the income from one particular piece of her New York real estate into the Henry Draper Memorial Fund. But in 1902, the city took over that property. "I have been seriously crippled in my income by the loss," she told Pickering. By juggling other holdings, she had succeeded in making ends meet through the spring of 1903, but still she felt pinched. "I have not forgotten that I owe to the general fund of the observatory nearly $1,000, and I hope another year to be able to repay it." Her anxiety prompted her to question the way her money was spent. Did all of it go toward the photographic study of stellar spectra? Or were the lines blurring between the observatory's several projects, possibly to her disadvantage? For example, she wondered to what extent her contribution funded the operation of the Bruce telescope at Arequipa, and how many of the photographs made with that instrument belonged to the Henry Draper Memorial, intended to examine stellar spectra. Moreover, she asked, was it wise to continue taking pictures of the entire sky, night after night, in both hemispheres? She knew she had approved this pursuit, and even provided one of the instruments for it. But where would it all end? Had not the accumulated abundance of plates already grown unmanageable? "I should be obliged," she wrote on June 15th, "if you will give me a statement as to what the observatory now possesses which you consider as belonging to the memorial, including instruments, plates, printed matter, manuscript, etc." Her questions staggered Pickering. Although his annual reports to the visiting committee discussed the progress of the observatory's various projects under separate subheadings, the work formed a grand unified edifice. Parallel lines of research met and entwined. Photographs of spectra led inevitably to discoveries of variable stars, which necessitated tracing changes of brightness backward and forward in time on stored images, which process revealed other objects of interest and suggested other studies. In sum, the spectra that Henry Draper had been first to capture on glass plates were now yielding not only the composition of the stars, as the doctor had once dreamed, but many other insights as well. Spectral evidence for motion in the line of sight, for example, had disclosed the speeds of many stars toward or away from the sun. Pickering and Miss Morey had found spectral line clues to the presence of two stars where only one had been previously known. Stars' relative temperatures could also be read in the spectrum by the intensity of their radiation at different wavelengths. Contrary to ordinary associations with the colors red and blue, the reddish stars were cool compared with those emitting mostly blue-white light. The smooth continuum of spectral types, the way the Draper classification categories evolved gradually from one to the next, suggested that the stars themselves evolved, perhaps changing from type to type over the course of a stellar lifetime. Pickering's reply to Mrs. Draper assured her that all the photographs taken with Draper instruments belonged to the Draper Memorial. Of course, he reminded her, each photograph becomes, like a book, a storehouse of information. It may thus be constantly consulted in future years. This is being done every day with many of the Draper chart photographs, at the expense of other funds. In the same way, in the study of the Draper Memorial of the variables discovered from their spectra, constant use is made of the great number of photographs taken with the Boyden, Bruce, and other instruments. Pickering also stressed the dedication of the Draper Memorial employees. You will be interested to hear that Mrs. Fleming, not contented with working all day at the observatory, has undertaken to continue the preparation of the Southern Draper catalog in the evenings at her home. A measuring apparatus has been made for her and a recorder provided. Mollified, Mrs. Draper wrote back. I regret to hear that Mrs. Fleming is taking up night work. I appreciate her zeal and interest, but fear she may overtax her strength and break down from overwork. I should prefer to hear she intended to take a long vacation. Mrs. Draper herself was preparing to sail for Europe in July. Before leaving, she thought she should revise her will so as to guarantee the permanent endurance of Henry's memorial. My purpose in providing funds for this memorial has been, as you know, to perpetuate the name of Dr. Draper, my husband, in connection with original work in astrophysics, and especially in the photographic study of stellar spectra, and to contribute to the increase of knowledge in this department of astronomy. But now she worried whether, in the course of years, this line of work might be exhausted and another avenue opened. In providing for the continuance of the work in my will, I have to remember that in a relatively short time, you and I will no longer be living, and I have to guard against the possibility that your successor may not be interested in this branch of research and may prefer to use the fund in some other direction if he can. In this, he may be wise, but I am not disposed to trust his judgment alone or that of the trustees of Harvard University, which would be practically the same thing. She thought a committee of competent astronomers might be appointed to make appropriate decisions when the time came. I appreciate highly the aid which you have given me during the past 17 years, she reminded Pickering, and the great amount of time and thought which you have bestowed on the work of this memorial. I believe its results are even now of the greatest interest, and whatever value they have is due to you. At night in the West Wing, at the eyepiece of the 6-inch telescope, Miss Cannon judged the brightness of the variable stars in her keeping. She used the time-honored technique, fathered by variable star pioneer Friedrich Wilhelm Argelander, of comparing each variable to nearby stars that were either a little bit brighter or just a tad dimmer. The smaller the difference between the target and its neighbor, the better her estimate. It was useless to attempt direct comparison by eye between the ultra-bright and the palest light, but the human retina could reliably gauge differences of 1/10 to 1/2 of a magnitude. Some of Miss Cannon's stars varied within that narrow range and could be contrasted with the same comparison star at every stage. For target variables that changed over time by wider margins than a fraction of a magnitude, Miss Cannon recruited two or more neighbors to use as benchmarks. She gave each star a numerical code name tied to its location and recorded all nuances in the accepted shorthand. Miss Cannon was not alone in her solitary pursuit. A few yards away, out on the iron balcony surrounding the dome of the Great Refractor, the junior man, Leon Campbell, tracked his assigned variables through the portable 5-inch telescope, or sometimes a field glass, and often by eye alone. All over New England, all over the country, really, and in foreign countries as well, other variable star observers were engaged in the same occupation. Many amateur astronomers had been enchanted by one of Pickering's pamphlets and acted on his suggestions as to which variables they should follow. At least once a month, when their local weather and the phase of the moon permitted, the members of this volunteer army assessed their star's brightness, gauging magnitudes by comparison, just as Miss Cannon did, and sent their observations to her at Harvard. She knew some of the more serious contributors by name, such as Frank Evans Seagrave, who owned a private observatory in Providence, Rhode Island, and Mary Watson Whitney, professor of astronomy and director of the student observatory at Vassar. Under Harvard's huge central dome, at the controls of the latest photometer, Oliver Wendell tracked the variable's slighter fluctuations, as small as 3/100ths of a magnitude. The director stood right beside him. Pickering remained devoted to these observations and kept account of the number of stellar assessments he made with each photometer he built. On the night of May 25, 1903, he recorded a personal milestone, his millionth photometric setting in the logbook. Pickering, afflicted with tuberculosis as a youth, had been warned against nighttime exposure at the start of his astronomical career. But by now, he could boast he had discovered the fresh air cure for consumption. The stars, Pickering knew, were telegraphing important behavioral clues by their variations in magnitude. Just as the patterns of spectral lines revealed stellar chemical components, so too the range of brightness changes over time concealed underlying truths, the nature of which had yet to be grasped. For now, one had merely to track and record the changes, trusting that someday the myriad readings would yield to interpretation. Pickering was never one to speculate when there were data to accumulate. Miss Cannon collected all the magnitude determinations made by co-workers and correspondents, and merged them with those of enthusiasts at overseas observatories, from Potsdam to Cape Town, who published their results in professional journals such as the Astronomische Nachrichten and the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society. Since 1900, when she took charge of Harvard's variable star card catalog, she had added 20,000 new index cards. In 1903, she turned the whole unwieldy database into a series of tables that could be read by any interested party. Miss Cannon's opus, a provisional catalog of variable stars, appeared in the annals and enjoyed immediate wide distribution. Numerous other variable star catalogs, including three by Seth Carlo Chandler, had preceded Miss Cannon's, and yet she called hers provisional. The term bowed to the quickening pace of ongoing discovery made possible by photography. A pre-photography catalog, published in Vienna in 1865, had listed the 113 variables then known. Miss Cannon's volume contained 1,227. More than half of these, 694, had been discovered on the Harvard glass plates. 509 in Solon-Bailey's globular clusters of the southern hemisphere, and 166 by Mrs. Fleming, who spotted their signal-bright hydrogen lines as she analyzed stellar spectra for the Henry Draper Memorial. Miss Cannon's tables digested a vast quantity of information, from the position of each variable and its name or other designation, to its maximum and minimum brightness, its period, and its spectral category in the Draper classification. One column specified the nature of each star's variability, whether it was a one-time wonder of the nova type, for example, or a regular repeater of short or long period. Here, Miss Cannon relied on the system framed by Pickering in 1880, which divided variables into five varieties. Like playing cards in a cosmic game of patience, the stars could be shuffled and dealt in various ways. One might sort them by suit, so to speak, according to their spectra, or by the numbered face value of their brightness as expressed in magnitudes. The five types of variable stars could be represented by the picture cards: jacks, queens, kings, aces, and wild. More than half of the 1,000-plus stars in Miss Cannon's catalog fell into Pickering's type 2, the long period variables. These took up to a year or even longer to cycle through their variations. She could not fathom the causes of their slow fluctuations in magnitude, or of the more rapid rises and dips typical of types 1, 3, and 4. Only the relatively rare type 5 variables changed brightness for a known reason. These were eclipsing binaries, meaning closely orbiting stars that took turns blocking each other's light. The type 5 paradigm, called Algol or the Ghoul in the constellation Perseus, dropped from magnitude 2.1 to 3.5 every 3 days, when the dimmer member of the pair passed in front of the brighter one. The resultant partial eclipse lasted 10 hours, after which Algol brightened again, right on schedule. Its regular and pronounced brightness changes, plain to the attentive naked eye, had attracted observers since the 1600s, and earned Algol the common nicknames of Winking Star and Demon Star. Mrs. Fleming, who liked to design and sew doll outfits for hospitals and fairs, portrayed Algol's dual personality as part of a series of astronomical dolls she crafted for the Arequipa families one Christmas, by pairing a large male Algol figure with a miniature black Dinah doll. In May 1902, she discovered an Algol type variable herself while chasing a comet's path through the glass plates. Her find was the most recent entry in Miss Cannon's provisional catalog. Unfortunately, Mrs. Fleming had no suitable spectrum with which to ascertain the new variable's Draper classification. Although she had graded Algol itself B8A and most of the other 22 Algol-type stars A, it was too soon to say where hers fit in the Harvard Draper scheme. Miss Cannon was content to leave a blank space in the spectrum column alongside the latest Algol discovery. A good number of other blank spaces in her tables pointed up other lacunae, such as missing minimum values, uncertain periods, absent spectra, or questionable variable type. But that was the point of a provisional catalog, was it not? To expose the gaps in knowledge? Henrietta Leavitt, the Radcliffe alumna and one-time assistant, came back to Cambridge in the fall of 1903. She had traveled twice to Europe and worked a few years as an art assistant at Beloit College in Wisconsin, near her family's current home, before realizing how much she missed the observatory. When she wrote to Pickering to say so, he offered her 30 cents an hour to return, a compromise between his regard for her abilities and the standard computer hourly rate of 25 cents. On these terms, she joined the new cadre of Carnegie-funded readers. Despite the earlier bon ami of Mr. Carnegie, his eponymous institution abruptly ended its support of the Harvard Observatory in December 1903, with scant prospect for the grant's renewal, Mrs. Fleming had to dismiss the corps of newly trained assistants, all except for Miss Levitt. Pickering freed other money to pay her salary as a full-time interpreter of texts in the Plate Library. For her first solo reading assignment, he gave her The Great Nebula in Orion. The Orion Nebula, the central gem in the Hunter's Sword, had been meticulously drawn and mapped by George Phillips Bond and famously photographed by Henry Draper. It remained a mysterious thicket of stars embedded in dark lanes of what appeared to be dust and gas. Recently, Max Wolf of Heidelberg had studied the nebula and found it studded with variables. Someone needed to follow up Wolf's observations to confirm the variability of all those stars. Pickering believed he had the right someone in Miss Levitt, as well as an incomparable collection of long exposures, some lasting several hours, to facilitate her search. Since Orion could be seen from both the northern and southern hemispheres, all the Harvard telescopes had photographed it, over a time span of more than 10 years. Miss Levitt waded into the nebula armed with an ingenious aid to brightness estimation, a little glass rectangle containing pictures of model stars at various magnitudes. This diminutive reference guide, about 1 inch by 3, framed in metal and attached to a long handle, resembled nothing so much as a miniature fly swatter. Miss Levitt liked to call it a fly spanker, since it was too small to do a fly much damage. Within 6 months, she had confirmed 16 of Wolf's variables and found more than 50 new ones, which were confirmed in turn by Mrs. Fleming. Miss Levitt achieved her next spate of discoveries by a different method. Edward King, the observatory's master photographer, made her a single positive plate from one of the many glass negatives of the Orion Nebula. On the glass positive, the stars shone white against a grainy gray background. Miss Levitt superposed each negative on this positive, then examined the combination through a magnifying loop. Unchanging stars tended to neutralize each other, but 8 new variables popped out at her. 2 months of this effort added another 77 variables to Miss Levitt's life list. She moved on to other nebulae in or near other constellations. She amassed another 200 variable stars in the 2 nebulae seen by Ferdinand Magellan when he circumnavigated the globe in the 1520s. To Magellan's eye, they had resembled a pair of luminous clouds afloat in the southern night sky. Astronomers who later resolved the clouds into star clusters still called them by Magellan's name. In early 1905, in the small Magellanic cloud alone, Miss Levitt uncovered 900 new variables. "What a variable star fiend Miss Levitt is," Charles Young of Princeton wrote in awe to Pickering on March 1, 1905. "One can't keep up with the roll of the new discoveries." Mrs. Draper expressed similar sentiments about Miss Levitt's remarkable discovery of variables on March 11th. As the tally continued to rise, Mrs. Draper wrote again in May to applaud the large number of variables in the small Magellan cloud. "It is certainly strange that so many of them should be found apparently close together. Will you please congratulate Miss Levitt for me?" She offered congratulations also to Pickering's brother William upon the discovery of the 10th satellite of Saturn, as he is now proprietor of 2 of the planet's attendants. William had waited 4 years for other astronomers to second his discovery of Phoebe, the 9th satellite of Saturn. By 1904, the little moon had been seen through several large telescopes other than the Bruce, and also proven to ply the most unusual orbit in the solar system. Phoebe circled Saturn in a backward or retrograde direction against the traffic flow of the other moons and rings. This discovery led William to the inescapable conclusion that Phoebe had started life as an errant asteroid. When she wandered too close to Saturn, the giant planet had captured her and constrained her in a retrograde orbit. William's success with Phoebe spurred him to examine more Bruce plates of Saturn's surroundings for signs of additional satellites. When he found what he believed to be the 10th moon, on April 28, 1905, he named it Themis, another Titaness of Greek mythology. He struggled with the calculation of its orbit, but none of the computers could be spared to assist him. As usual at the Harvard Observatory, the stars took precedence over the planets. Edward Pickering kept fellow astronomers abreast of Miss Leavitt's advances by issuing a rapid-fire series of circulars. A few of these publications included small prints showing parts of the images she inspected. The prints, magnified for clarity and crowded with tens to hundreds of thousands of stars, conveyed the flavor of her Herculean task, which included approximating the percentage of variables per plate. It is very difficult to count the faint stars which cloud the background, Pickering said with obvious understatement, on account of their closeness to one another, and the number is certainly underestimated. Occasionally, Pickering described one of Miss Leavitt's finds as a nova or an Algol variable, but the great majority of her variables demonstrated only slight changes of about half a magnitude over very short timescales. Perpetually aflutter, they cycled from maximum to minimum at least once every day. Their rapid fluctuations engendered a new photographic approach, involving several successive short exposures on the same plate, so that each star appeared as a series of dots. When Mrs. Draper visited for a couple of days, she professed herself more impressed than ever with the vast work accomplished. "You live so constantly in the midst of it," she wrote to Pickering on May 29, 1905, "that you cannot so well appreciate it." Pickering reprised his library metaphor in the fall of 1905 to deplore the underutilization of the plate stacks. The nearly 200,000 glass volumes drew only 20 readers to their contents, and the director was desperate for more. Harvard President Charles Eliot agreed to help. "I expect to be in Mr. Carnegie's house in New York on the 15th of November," he wrote to Pickering from his office in the yard, "and will then promote a visit by Mr. and Mrs. Carnegie to our observatory if I have the opportunity." Mrs. Fleming also tried to revive the philanthropist's interest in the plate library. She sent a long letter to his wife, Louise Whitfield Carnegie, along with a small gift. Mrs. Carnegie responded warmly from the family's vacation cottage in Fernandina, Florida, on January 11, 1906. "We left New York 3 days after Christmas and have been so occupied getting ourselves established here for the winter that I am only just able to turn my thoughts to the many kindnesses showered upon us at the Christmas season by our friends. Chief among these kindnesses is your own great kindness to us, the wonderful Story of the Stars in its dainty Christmas dress, with the remarkable lantern slides, form one of the most unique, lovely greetings that can be imagined. And when we think of your kindness in taking all this thought for us, words fail me to express how deeply we are touched and how truly we appreciate this precious gift. Then, too, may I add, when this gift is the original work of the great discoverer herself, are we not indeed a favored people, and are we not blessed in knowing her? We are so proud of you as a Scotch woman and proud of your womanhood, for I believe the feminine mind is more capable of fathoming the eternal thought, just as the feminine heart nestles closer to nature and to nature's God." After explaining the purpose of the Florida stay as a way to woo back our little daughter to robust health, Mrs. Carnegie closed with the hope that "we may someday have the great pleasure of welcoming you, not only to our New York home, but better than that, give you a Highland welcome to our home in bonny Scotland." Mrs. Carnegie had been born in the Gramercy Park neighborhood of New York City, but regarded herself Scottish by association with Andrew, who had come from Dunfermline. Margaret Carnegie, the couple's only child, was a precocious 9-year-old with a sprained ankle. Mrs. Fleming felt a bond with Miss Margaret that inspired her to send frequent tokens she thought the child might enjoy, including pictures of stars, a book that described the laying of transoceanic cables, and even a specimen of cable. "It gave me great pleasure to learn from your letter of February 16th, she told Mrs. Carnegie, "that Miss Margaret was gaining in health and was enjoying herself in the sunshine and flowers of beautiful Florida. Also, that the Valentines afforded her some amusement. On the evening of February 13th, my brother and I spent the whole evening doing up and addressing Valentines for schoolmates and friends of his little fellows. Outside my scientific work, my next joy in life lies in giving pleasure to others." Over the ensuing months, Mrs. Fleming continued to unbosom herself to Mrs. Carnegie. "Of my own two boys, only one lived to grow up. He is 26 years of age and is one of President Pritchett's boys, having graduated from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in 1901. He is a mining engineer, especially interested in copper, and has been with the Phelps Dodge Company at their Copper Queen property in Douglas, Arizona, during the last year and a half. He is a good boy and makes true friends wherever he goes, but being a boy and in such a profession, he is away from me almost all the time. I am not in danger of being lonely, however, as I have my mother to look after, and she keeps us stirring." Mrs. Fleming's youngest brother, a recent widower, and his two sons, ages 8 and 12, also lived with her. A newspaper announcement of the Carnegies' travel plans alerted Mrs. Fleming to the fact that their spring stay in New York would be brief. The news seemed to rule out the possibility of their visiting Cambridge to see the observatory, in which case, she said, she would wait patiently for the fall, in the hope of welcoming them then. Mrs. Fleming received perhaps the most pleasant shock of her life on May 11, 1906, just 4 days before her 49th birthday, when the Royal Astronomical Society elected her to honorary membership. The society, formed in 1820, had recognized the role of women astronomers early in its history by awarding a gold medal to Caroline Herschel in 1828 for her several discoveries of comets. No woman could be admitted as a full fellow, of course, but over the years, the society had made honorary members of a few female British subjects, including, most recently in 1903, Lady Margaret Huggins, the wife of Sir William Huggins, Henry Draper's old rival. Mrs. Fleming became the first American woman to earn the distinction, or rather the first woman doing astronomical work in America. She was still a Scotswoman through and through, with the brogue to prove it. But after her long and productive residency in the United States, she thought it might be high time she applied for American citizenship. Pickering had likened the plate collection to a library lacking readers. In 1906, the observatory's visiting committee compared it to a gold mine minus a refinery, like a mining company which has put out of the ground a vast quantity of precious ore, but lacks the means for reducing the ore and preparing the metal for market. The observatory possesses a great store of knowledge in the rough, but wants the means for working this knowledge into useful shape for the benefit of the world. Solon Bailey, still in Cambridge and elated by the burgeoning population of variable stars, urged Pickering in 1906 to unite the astronomers of the world in a new cooperation. Miss Leavitt had worked alone in a few isolated regions of space. Surely, her phenomenal findings justified canvassing photographs of the whole sky in order to determine the number and distribution of all variable stars to the faintest magnitudes possible. Without such a concerted approach, Bailey feared, any search would be plagued by needless duplication and wasted effort. Pickering concurred. He issued another circular, inviting observatories everywhere to equip themselves with the proper telescopes and cameras, to study the distribution of the variable stars and learn what part they play in the construction of the stellar universe. Pickering estimated the sky held as many as 50 million stars brighter than 16th magnitude. He wanted to test the constancy of every last one of them. The comparison of such a vast number of stars on several plates is indeed so great an undertaking that at first it seems impossible, he allowed in his announcement. But the outcome he foresaw would be a worthy achievement for the present generation of observers. Given Harvard's position at the variable star vanguard, Pickering did not wait for others to heed his call. He pushed forward with his own research assistants and limited resources. He asked Miss Cannon and Miss Evelyn Leland to master Miss Leavitt's method. Then he divided the heavens, like Gaul, into three parts and apportioned one to each of them. Lizzie Pickering had fallen and broken her ankle in her bedroom in February 1903. And from that point on, her health had gradually deteriorated. The break incapacitated her for more than 6 months. When she could walk again, she did not feel up to resuming her former activities. She did not even attend the party at Anna Draper's house in New York on December 29, 1905, to celebrate the 20th anniversary of the Henry Draper Memorial. Mrs. Draper laid her friend's absence to a merely temporary illness, but upon visiting the Pickerings in March 1906, she could see the seriousness of the situation well enough. Afterward, she wrote Pickering to say she hoped his wife would soon be better. What else could one hope? In May, when Mrs. Draper desired yet another tour of progress at the observatory, she stayed at the Brunswick in Copley Square and made plain she did not expect to be entertained. "Do not take the trouble to have luncheon for me, for I can take an early lunch at the hotel." Mrs. Draper also wrote directly to Mrs. Pickering, continuing their cordial correspondence as though it might carry on indefinitely. So many times over the years, their thoughts had turned toward each other at the same moment, with the curious result that their letters often crossed in the mail. Mrs. Pickering's surgery in June 1906 succeeded in easing her pain, but neither she nor her husband believed it would extend her life. They shaped their plans accordingly. All that summer, the director kept up his work at the observatory, just a few steps away from Mrs. Pickering's sick room in the residence. In mid-August, when he learned that the English astronomers John and Mary Orr Evershed were en route to Cambridge, he cabled their ship to welcome them as graciously as possible under the circumstances. "The very serious illness of Mrs. Pickering may prevent our entertaining you at our house, as otherwise we should wish to do." Mrs. Pickering died on August 29th and was buried in Mount Auburn Cemetery near the graves of her parents, Jared and Mary Sparks. "My future interests in life are likely to be somewhat restricted, and my years of usefulness cannot be very numerous," Pickering predicted to Edwin P. Seaver of the visiting committee 2 weeks later. "The needs of the observatory are so pressing, and so much could be accomplished by an immediate expenditure, that I am inclined to give it a large part of my savings." In September, he paid the first installment of a promised $25,000 to be dispersed over the next 3 months, challenging other donors to contribute its equivalent. Along with the many expressions of sympathy, Pickering received an appeal that autumn from Elizabeth Lidstone Bond, a granddaughter of the observatory's first director. Miss Bond apologized for intruding at such a time, but she and her sister required his advice on a personal matter. "You know, of course, of my Aunt Selina's poverty," she wrote on October 13th. He did know of it, yes. Sudden poverty had driven Selina Cranch Bond to beg Pickering, almost the moment he took over the observatory in 1877, for employment. Although her father, William Cranch Bond, had provided for his heirs through the family's profitable watch, clock, and chronometer manufactory in Boston, A scurrilous trustee later cheated the descendants out of their inheritance. Pickering was still sending Miss Bond occasional computing work that she, now 75, could do at home in Rockland, Maine. Elizabeth and her sister Catherine, the daughters of George Phillips Bond, had been impoverished by the same blow dealt their Aunt Selina. They, too, had worked briefly for Pickering, as copyists and translators, before establishing themselves as schoolteachers. Elizabeth thought her Aunt Selina, the aged daughter of an eminent man like my grandfather, as poor as she is, might justly claim assistance from a particular Harvard pension fund. The sisters hoped Pickering could direct them to a member of the pension fund committee and counsel them about how to proceed. Given your position in the observatory and the unfailing kindness and consideration you have always shown us. Elizabeth conceded the many difficulties likely involved, not least her aunt's unwillingness to accept money from anyone. She has made her independence her religion. Pickering assured the anxious nieces of his aid and wrote the same day to President Eliot to inquire about the pension fund. On learning that it could support former faculty members only, Pickering devised an annuity tailored to the situation. He would put $1,000 of his own, to be matched by sums from the Bond sisters and their cousins, into the Harvard Corporation for Investment. Starting immediately, Selina Bond would receive $500 a year, nearly double her present salary as a part-time at-home computer, for as long as she lived. In addition, she would be relieved of all responsibilities and granted the title of assistant emerita in the observatory. In consideration of the distinguished and long-continued service to astronomy of her father, her brother, and herself. Perhaps you can suggest some better arrangement, Pickering wrote to the Bond sisters. In any case, she had better not know where the money comes from, but receive her first notification from the college treasurer. Elizabeth and Catherine Bond embraced the plan, except that they refused to let the director pay even so much as $1 toward its execution. May I add this moral? Catherine asked Pickering in mid-November, when all the arrangements had been settled, and her aunt surprised but gratified by the recognition conferred. In your loneliness and sorrow, it must be some consolation to you that in these past weeks, you have been lifting such a weight of anxiety from the sister and daughters of your predecessor. So often my sister and I have been glad that you were our father's successor, but never more so than now. Chapter 8. Lingua Franca. Throughout 1906, the triumvirate of variable star hunters, the Misses Cannon, Levitt, and Leland, combed piecemeal through Harvard's photographic maps of the sky. Each woman's third of the heavens encompassed a score of subdivisions to be searched individually and repeatedly. Henrietta Levitt, whether because of her greater previous experience or the luck of the draw in the sectors assigned to her, took an early lead. She found 93 new variables within months of the hunt's start in 1906, trailed by Annie Cannon with 31 and Evelyn Leland, 8. Competition for the most discoveries played no part in their pursuit, but Pickering tallied and reported the women's sums. Given the overall quest to learn the distribution of all types of stars in the universe, the absence of variables from a particular region provoked almost as much interest as a strong presence. Pickering might have trisected the sky by giving Miss Cannon the North Pole, Miss Levitt the tropics, and Miss Leland the far south, where she was already well acclimated thanks to years of helping Professor Bailey sift the content of his star clusters. Instead of a gross division by celestial latitude, however, the director parceled out the 55 parts of Harvard's map of the sky as though dealing a hand of rummy. Thus, Miss Cannon received section numbers 1, 4, 7, 10, and so on, Miss Leland numbers 2, 5, 8, 11, etc., and Miss Levitt the rest. For each stellar region, each lady gathered plates in quintuplicate, four negatives, forming a time-lapse series, plus a positive print, white stars on dark background from a fifth date, to serve as a basis for comparison. One by one, as Miss Leavitt had done in her exploration of the Orion Nebula, each negative was laid atop its corresponding print. Stars of constant brightness neutralized the differences between their positive and negative images. Variables showed their colors, in black and white, to the practiced eye. The women marked all suspects for further investigation. Some of these panned out as truly new finds, others as familiar faces from previous dragnets. With more time or more woman power, Pickering might have allotted more than five plates per area. But the efficient protocol made the most sense under current constraints. It even allowed him to approximate how many variables escaped detection. If, say, Miss Leavitt located 10 in one section, 9 of which proved to be new, never claimed by another observatory or captured in an earlier Harvard search, then many more undiscovered variables likely resided nearby. If, however, among 10 identified, 9 turned out to be already known, then very few others still lurked in that zone. Found two new variables, Miss Cannon noted in her diary on Saturday, February 23, 1907. Went to the club, very cold. Her club, the Women's College Club of Boston, often drew her out for dinner and entertainment. The extreme cold persisted through Sunday. Did not go to church. After quitting the house on Upland Road to make room for Mrs. Fleming's mother, brother, and two nephews, Miss Cannon invited her widowed older half-sister in Delaware, Ella Cannon Marshall, to come live with her in Cambridge. They spent almost every free evening and Sunday together, attending concerts and lectures, shopping, dining with friends, poring at ladies' teas. Miss Cannon's Acousticon carbon hearing aid enabled her to enjoy all these things. Sometimes she brought Miss Leland or another co-worker home from the observatory to lunch with Sissy. As Miss Cannon searched the deep space of the map plates for new variables, she continued her telescope observations and augmented her index card collection. Having twice updated her provisional catalog of variable stars to append the new crops of 1903 and 1904, she hardly expected her second catalog of variable stars, published in 1907, to be her final word on the subject. Miss Cannon was a census taker in the midst of a population explosion. The second catalog, though comprehensive, concentrated on the variable stars of long period. It did not include the multitude of short period variables Miss Leavitt had uncovered in the Magellanic Clouds. Those required a separate treatment, currently nearing completion by Miss Leavitt herself. It may be asked, Solon Bailey wrote in an article for Popular Science Monthly, why it is necessary or even desirable to go on indefinitely with the discovery of new variables. Aside from the value of adding any new